We are joined in the studios once again with Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Still trying to get used to the time shift here with doing the show.
Doing the show in the afternoon instead of in the mornings, early mornings.
It's going to take me another 10 years to get used to it. All right. So plenty to cover, starting out with local. And last week you were talking about the different candidates for District 4.
This week on Monday, the city council chose Abel Pacheco to fill the District 4 seat that was vacated by Rob Johnson after Rob Johnson decided to leave his job, his city council position, early so that he could take up his job with the NHL. The city council, after four rounds of voting, chose Abel Pacheco. Four candidates were nominated for the voting on Monday, four out of the 11 qualified candidates. Pacheco was nominated by Teresa Mosqueda. Lorena Gonzalez then nominated Brooke Broad. Sally Bagshaw nominated transportation planner David Goldberg, who also had support from Mike O'Brien. That's one of O'Brien's key issues that he's always been on top of, is transportation. And Shama Sawant nominated union organizer Sheree Lascelles. In the first round of voting, Pacheco won four votes, just one vote short of a majority, from Mosqueda, Deborah Juarez, Lisa Herbold, and Bruce Harrell. In the second round of voting, Herbold and Harrell switched their votes to Brooke Broad. But again, no single candidate won a majority of votes. When the third round produced a similar result, Council President Bruce Harrell called a pause for discussion, after which Sally Bagshaw switched her vote to Abel Pacheco. And then Lisa Herbold and Bruce Harrell joined Teresa Mosqueda and Deborah Juarez to give Pacheco a one-vote majority. At 31 years old, he'll be the youngest member on the council. He had also joined the race for the District 4 seat this year, so he was running for that seat. But he said on Monday that he'll withdraw from the running now that he will be filling that seat for the next few months. He ran for this seat back in 2015 when Johnson won that election. He also applied for Tim Burgess's vacant seat when Burgess stepped into the role of interim mayor after Ed Murray resigned back in 2017. That was when Kirsten Harris-Talley was chosen to fill Burgess's seat instead. The big issues in District 4 right now, of course, is the upzone of the Ave. Excuse me. Under pressure from small businesses on the Ave, Rob Johnson had pulled the Ave from the MHA upzones earlier this year, or perhaps late last year. But just before leaving office, Johnson then put the Ave upzones back on the table in his Planning, Land Use, and Zoning Committee, kind of a parting shot to all those people who were against the upzones. Pacheco will take over as chair of that committee. He said on Monday that he tentatively supports upzones along the Ave, but that he's willing to meet with Ave businesses to, quote-unquote, alleviate their concerns, whether that means actually listening to what those business owners have to say, or merely acting as a punching bag and then turning around and voting for the upzones, just rubber stamping them. We'll just have to wait and see. But I encourage anybody who works or lives along the Ave and is concerned about upzoning the Ave to contact his office as soon as possible. Now, in addition to working for the University of Washington, Pacheco served as a communications and program specialist for the Seattle Police Foundation, a nonprofit that raises money to provide training and equipment for Seattle police officers, as well as running community partnerships, in other words, community outreach for the Seattle Police Department. So there's also the issue of how he would vote if a revised labor contract comes up before the city council later this year. Given that Judge Robart, the judge that is overseeing police reform in Seattle, has expressed concerns about the labor contract, the new labor contract, violating the city's own laws that the city council passed last year on police reform, that contract might be rejected by the judge, and then the city would be back to the drawing board, drawing up a new contract. And that would, of course, have to come, not just be agreed on by the mayor's office and the Seattle Police Department, but also, and the Seattle Police Officers Guild, but would also have to be voted on by the city council. So I think it's an open question of whether or not he would just rubber stamp whatever the mayor and the Seattle Police Officers Guild decide. The council will also be looking at revisions to the current two-year city budget starting in late summer. So Pacheco will be part of that process for deciding how money should be allocated to various programs. Of special interest will be funding for the city's housing and homelessness services and for the city's navigation team. Now, Pacheco is, of course, he's a current employee. He will probably be leaving his job, however, at the University of Washington. And a lot of people could look at that and say, well, you know, the University of Washington is the big whale in District 4. It's the biggest employer. It's the big, it kind of throws its weight around quite a bit in District 4 politics already. Do we need another representative of the University of Washington to come in and represent District 4 this year? My argument was that no, we didn't need that, but the city council apparently feels differently.
Yeah, and they have to be pretty psyched about his nomination, again, dealing with the properties along the Ave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I know there are a lot of developers lined up and thinking, wow, wouldn't it be great to put in, you know, mixed residential and commercial development along the Ave if we can just get higher than a couple of stories. Unfortunately, that means when developers come in and they tear down lower rent properties, smaller, lower rent storefronts, and put in big developments, the commercial properties are not affordable for those businesses to rent. They can't afford to pay the amount of money that those landlords will be asking for. And so that displaces a lot of iconic businesses that have been in the U District that have been here, you know, since I was a student or have been here, you know, for decades. A lot of those businesses are run by families and by immigrants. So that would also be an issue, too. That was one of the main arguments that businesses made that Rob Johnson agreed to, and that's why he pulled the university, the Ave, from the upzone. But of course, you know, we don't know if Pacheco has heard that and if he agrees with that assessment or not.
So, in a way, it continues on the rotating door between city council and University of Washington.
Yeah,
former council member Sally Clark, who now heads up a lot of those efforts at University of Washington. All right. You touched on one of the issues you're going to be dealing with is
housing and homelessness services. Yeah. On Monday, Mayor Durkin sent a snotty email to the city council that she was dropping her nomination of Jason Johnson for director of the Human Services Department. Johnson has been serving as the interim director since Catherine Lester stepped down early last year, I believe in March of last year. According to Human Services Department employees, after Lester left in March of last year, Durkin had promised that she would conduct an open search for a new permanent director for the Human Services Department. But the mayor then surprised everyone on New Year's Eve by announcing that she had changed her mind and wanted the council to approve Johnson as permanent director. After protests from over 130, now a lot of times critics of the folks who are against Jason Johnson, people who support Johnson, will say, oh, just a handful of Human Services Department employees are unhappy. It was actually over 130 Human Services Department employees who signed a petition asking the mayor to not appoint Johnson as the permanent director, but to open up the search process like she had said she would and do a search similar to what she had done for the head of City Light and the head of the Seattle Police Department. And a letter of protest was also sent by the Human Services Coalition. So it's not just Cher Wheel. A lot of the critics of this whole process have said, oh, it's only Cher Wheel who hates Johnson. But no, it was a formal letter of protest from the Human Services Coalition, which is a group of social service providers who help seniors, people of color, and the disabled, as well as provide services to the homeless. And also council member Shama Sawant refused to take up Johnson's nomination in her committee. And she asked the mayor instead to fulfill her promise of an open search. Council members Gonzalez and Mosqueda also sent a letter to Mayor Durkin requesting that she conduct an open search. And after the mayor's legislative liaison, Anthony Ariema, responded to that letter from Mosqueda and Gonzalez, he wrote a scolding, patronizing letter in response to council member Sawant back in February. The full council then voted to move Johnson's nomination to a separate committee for a final vote, a committee of the entire council. But that vote was canceled by Sally Bagshaw, which without any explanation. And it really indicates to me that Bagshaw couldn't get a majority of votes to confirm Johnson among the 9 council members, or the 8 if you want to if you want to talk about Rob Johnson having left the city council early. She might have been able to get him confirmed if Johnson had stayed, but he didn't. Now we get Mayor Durkin's response. She has withdrawn Johnson's nomination and says she will keep him on as interim director through at least the end of this year. She is not going to open up a new search, and she's not going to appoint anyone else. That means, of course, that Durkin's waiting for the November election to see if she can get a more favorable mix of city council members elected who will rubber stamp her nominees. And she may, if she's satisfied with the mix of city council members that are elected this November, she might resubmit Johnson's nomination early next year. Now, at the council's meeting on Monday, Jason Johnson testified before the council about the new data-driven approach that the city is using to deliver human services and to decide and to make decisions about which organizations the city will fund to provide those services. This comes after the Human Service Department acknowledged back in early March that the way the council counts, the way that the Human Services Department counts exits from homelessness can actually double count or triple count or even quadruple count people. On the other hand, homeless services providers have been complaining that the city undercounts exits from homelessness by not counting when a homeless person moves in with a friend or family member or goes into transitional housing. Because these are not considered, quote unquote, exits into permanent housing, end quote. So the city ends up financially penalizing homeless service providers for not meeting its metrics, even though they are actually helping people get off the streets and helping people make decisions about what type of aid would be the best for them in their own situation. So that raises the question of what metrics is the Human Services Department using? How did they come up with those? How are they measuring those? And are they accurate? The city council is not clear on that. And that was a big topic in the Monday's city council meeting questioning Jason Johnson. The council wanted to hear from him how the HSD could provide more information to the council and the public on what their metrics are and how they come up with them. But of course, he didn't give any specific answers on that. He just acknowledged that there's a debate about how to measure, quote unquote, success in the city's response to homelessness. But he did not give a specific timetable for when the Human Services Department would make this information public. Clearly, he's stalling. And that could be because he knows the metrics are not accurate, but also it's because he's dead center in that political tug of war between the mayor and the city council. The mayor wants to award contracts to her buddies and to cut money to groups she doesn't like Share Wheel, for example. She's also playing a waiting game over the election in November. And the city council, of course, is trying to exercise their oversight authority, which is you know, what they're supposed to be doing as an elected body of representatives that are representing the people of Seattle, not the mayor's interests.
Or the
or the interests,
Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, the interests of the Chamber of Commerce.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's talk a little bit about how this week was the Tough on Crime Week in Seattle.
Oh, I didn't see that on my calendar.
No, it wasn't on your calendar. But apparently it was on the calendar for the mainstream media and for businesses and for, you know, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. You know, last month, Como News ran a conservative Tough on Crime editorial piece that they called Seattle is Dying, and they tried to talk it up as a documentary. It focused on homelessness, drug use, and crime. It also tended to make people who are homeless look like they are all criminals and that they are all committing crimes because they are drug abusers, which is very, very far from being true. Now, this week, the Seattle Times jumped on the bandwagon and ran their own editorial entitled Seattle's Persistent Crime Problem Demands Change. In that article, the Seattle Times attempted to show that crime has surged in, quote unquote, some neighborhoods. Now, first of all, you have to be wary when someone starts cherry picking specific neighborhoods to talk about. Secondly, the so-called surge in crime since 2014, it, just by the statistic that the Seattle Times piece presents in their article, appears to be driven by thefts, robberies, and burglaries, not violent crimes, with about three quarters of the crimes being under larceny theft. Now, let's explain what those terms are. Robberies are when someone uses force when they steal something. So, for example, if a mugger comes up and punches you in the face and steals your purse or takes your wallet, that's a robbery. If burglaries are involve breaking and entering, so if someone, while you're at work, breaks into your home and steals a bunch of your stuff, that's a robbery.
Or your car.
Or that's a burglary. Or your car breaks the window of your car and steals your purse or steals something valuable out of your car. That's a burglary. But as I said, three quarters of the crimes listed in each of these neighborhoods, between two-thirds and three-quarters of the crimes, were larceny theft. Well, what is larceny theft? Larceny theft is nonviolent theft, essentially. So it could be pickpockets, could be a purse snatcher who doesn't use force. Maybe you walked away from your table in a restaurant, somebody stole your purse. Or more likely, the vast bulk of them are going to be shoplifting offenses. So going into a big chain store, you know, that has a big multiple entrances at a big front entrance, you know, has a lot of people coming and going all the time and only a few employees to watch and you know, people shoplifting and walking out the door with stuff they stuffed in their pockets.
Like the articles that came out, I think it was either this week or the tail end of last week about Goodwill, and that the bulk of the items stolen there were again by homeless people. Mm-hmm. And those are the cases that the city is choosing to prosecute. Yeah. It's just those.
Who need clean socks, who need, you know, a second pair of pants, whose belongings were stolen by the city when they swept a homeless encampment, and now they have no clothes, that kind of thing. That all falls under larceny theft, and that's the vast majority of the increase in crime that this article is talking about. And still, those statistics that the Seattle Times cites are much, much lower than the crime statistics from the 1980s, which is when I first moved to Seattle in the early 1990s. Now, for example, violent crimes are almost 40% lower than they were in 1985, and that's just the raw number of crimes. If you take into consideration population growth since the mid-1980s and you decide to look at the crime rate or the number of crimes per person in the city of Seattle, then the difference is even more dramatic. The violent crime rate is less than half now than what it was in the 1980s and the early 90s. Robberies are less than half. Burglaries are less than a third of what they were 30 years ago. That's according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program. The increase in crime that the Seattle Times is complaining about is primarily shoplifting. So what's really driving this tough on crime posturing by our local media outlets? Well, of course, it's the vocal nature of big businesses saying, you know, we want to get these homeless people off the street. We want to lower our costs. We want to make more money. We want our profits to be secure. So do something about, there's this wave of shoplifting crime. We want you to do something about it. But they don't want the city to do things that will actually help. For example, to get people into permanent housing, to build more affordable to tax big businesses to build more affordable housing. And of course, it's a bid to influence the upcoming city council elections by making up a non-existent crime wave to bolster these conservative business-friendly candidates that they're running too. So instead of actually doing things like programs that help people get off of drugs. For example, a lot of shoplifting is done by people with a drug habit who can't afford to pay for the drugs that they need to keep from going into withdrawal. instead of paying for more drug treatment programs, for more diversion programs that keep people out of jail and divert them into drug treatment programs and permanent housing and inexpensive job training to help them get a decent paying job. These businesses want to just throw money into locking people up and keep and throwing away the key. So, for example, the Seattle Times quoted Judge Ed McKenna, who's the presiding judge in Seattle Municipal Court, as saying that the bulk of offenders are coming into Seattle from other states just so they can take advantage of our services and take advantage of our lax law enforcement. And that directly contradicts the city's own statistics on who makes up the homeless population in Seattle. It's primarily people from Washington State, with the bulk of them from King County and the Puget Sound area. Now, on Wednesday, city attorney... Oh, no, you had a question.
No, right? No, you actually are starting to... I was saying, wasn't McKenna just in the paper this week?
Oh, yes. That was why he was in the paper. But also because on Wednesday, city attorney Pete Holmes united with his adversary, Anita Candelwall, who is director of the King County Department of Public Defense, to send a protest letter to Judge McKenna asking him to stop his political grandstanding. And yes, the head of our public prosecutors, city attorney Pete Holmes, united with the head of our Public Defenders Association to request that Judge McKenna step down as the presiding municipal court judge. Among other things, they accused him of regularly criticizing the sentencing recommendations of the city attorney's office for not being strict enough or suggesting long enough jail time. He also badmouthed the LEAD program, which is one of the main programs that diverts people who've committed petty crimes from serving jail time if they agree to go into drug treatment programs instead. So there's this political movement now that's seeking to criminalize poverty, homelessness, and mental illness. Speak Out Seattle is part of it. Judge McKenna has gotten on the bandwagon. Our big local media outlets have bought into it. The conservative Seattle Times and Como News have gotten on board. And it's going to be a big issue coming up in the city council elections, not just homelessness and housing. How do you help these folks? But how do you deal with this criminalization of homelessness, of homeless folks? And how do you deal with these criminal repeat offenders? You know, I mean, that's going to be the way they try to frame it. And it's going to be a struggle for progressive activists. And it's going to be a struggle for progressive candidates and a struggle for people who are involved in the human services and helping people get off the street. It's going to be a struggle for them to reframe the debate in a way that mirrors reality and that actually helps to solve the problems.
So I guess we're waiting on the Seattle Times to do the companion article about the increase in white collar crime here in the city, and all the
or the criminal activities of Boeing and taking shortcuts in the manufacture of their planes. I don't know. Anyway, so let's move on.
All right, on to Olympia then.
Yeah, some of the bills that have reached the governor's desk now. House Bill 1196, that's the bill for permanent daylight savings time in Washington state. Federal law allows states to opt for permanent standard time, but not for permanent daylight savings time. Washington's new law says that if Congress ever allows states to opt for permanent daylight savings time, then Washington will immediately shift to that. This comes after California voters passed a similar law last year, and the Oregon and Idaho legislatures are considering similar laws in their states, which is important because then that means the entire West Coast would be on the same time if Congress ever allows it. So at this stage, you can call your local congressional representative. I would recommend looking up your U.S. congressional district and finding out who that is and ask them to introduce a bill in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and then call Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell and ask them to do the same in the Senate.
Let them know it's about time.
It is about time. Uh-huh. Another bill that is now on the governor's desk is Senate Bill 5116 to phase out fossil fuels and electricity generation. We talked about that a little bit last week. That's now up for Inslee to sign, and I have no doubt that he will. So is House Bill 1112, which phases out the use of hydrofluorocarbons, a type of greenhouse gas, from use in industrial refrigeration units. Also, House Bill 1257, which would come up with new energy standards for buildings larger than 50,000 square feet. and would also set rules for electric vehicles charging stations in new buildings. And so is House Bill 1444 to set stronger efficiency standards for appliances that use electricity and water. Three more interesting bills also reached the governor's desk this week. House Bill 1739 will ban outright undetectable plastic guns that can be made on a 3D printer. Any gun that has less than 3.7 ounces of steel and any gun that doesn't show a recognizable outline in an X-ray machine would be banned in the state of Washington. There would also be limits on manufacturing untraceable guns, that is metal guns made out of the usual material that you make guns out of that don't have serial numbers on them. There are a lot of folks who are sort of build at home folks who like to build their own weapons, you know, make their own ammunition, et cetera, who can order gun kits and make their own guns that don't have serial numbers on them. And this bill would impose limits on retailers who sell those kits. They would have to make sure that they're not selling kits to someone who has a felony conviction or is otherwise not supposed to own a firearm. So they would have to do background checks. Now, Senate Bill 5001 also hit the governor's desk. That will allow natural organic reduction of human remains. In other words, Washington State will become the first state in the union where you can opt to be composted instead of cremated or buried in a casket upon your death. And let's hope that the governor signs that one and doesn't just let it languish.
It's another bin we're going to have to push to the curb each week.
No, you wouldn't be doing it at home.
Oh, okay.
If the bill does pass and is signed into law, there would be businesses that would have that would be able to offer that as a service, in addition to other funeral type services. And a lot of funeral homes would then be able to ramp up and offer that as a service in addition to their other standard offerings of cremation and casket and so forth. Now, House Bill 1638 also passed. And is on the governor's desk. It adds the following wording to state law, quote, a philosophical or personal objection may not be used to exempt a child from measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. This comes in a week when California suffered an outbreak of measles that exposed potentially hundreds of college students to one of the most highly contagious diseases you can contract. While it's unlikely that a college student would die from the measles, it's not unlikely that maybe one of their grandparents would die, or perhaps a baby in their family could die from it. In fact, this year, 22 states have seen measles outbreaks. The total number of people who have been counted so far by the medical profession is up around 700 in the United States. And it's probably more than that because there are probably many people who have contracted measles who didn't realize that they had it because their illness wasn't severe enough for them to go to the doctor. They maybe thought they just had a cold or the flu. Public health officials think that it's just a matter of time before we do start to see deaths, however, because this measles outbreak is now the most severe one that we've seen since the year 2000 when measles was declared eradicated in the United States. I want to also say Sunday is the last day of the legislative session in Olympia, and Democrats are working hard on finalizing a package of budget bills. That supposedly they are releasing their budget bills today, which means, of course, there will be very little time for anyone to examine them before they vote on them tomorrow, the last day of the legislative session. But there shouldn't be any secret to anyone what those bills contain, because those bills have been talked about. They've had hearings. They've been discussed and amended over the previous weeks. So we know that there is discussion of a progressive real estate excise tax, and that will probably make the cut in the budget bill. That means that anyone who sells their home and pays the real estate excise tax upon the sale of their home or of other property in the state of Washington, there will now be a graduated tax. If your property is worth less than a certain amount, you'll be paying a lower rate. If it's higher than a certain amount, you'll be paying a higher rate. That's what that means. That's meant to be a progressive tax and to raise revenue for the state of Washington to help pay some of the other things that the state government needs to take care of, like upgrades to the mental health system in the state of Washington, and to help fill some of the funding for the new K through 12 funding program that the state of Washington passed last year.
Yeah, I saw a posting by one of our elected representatives from Olympia that said they're up till at least 4 a.m. Last night working on this.
Working on amendments and getting it all hammered out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we will see next, we'll talk about next week what actually passed. But we're right at the midpoint of the show, and while we're talking about finances and funding, I would like to just put in a little plug here for KODX. If you enjoy the content that we air here on KODX, you really like
or you find it
Eat the Airwaves, or you find it of value. Maybe you don't enjoy it. Maybe you yell at your radio when you're listening. That's all right.
That's but okay, you tune, but you still, close the windows.
You still tune in on a regular basis because it's become necessary for you to understand how the world works and how things are, why things are happening, when they're happening, and who's doing them and why. Then please go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon button and become a regular sustaining contributor to KODX and to our programming. We do need funding, and we're a nonprofit. We're all volunteer, and we rely on the support of our listeners.
Yeah, you support your local independent media.
Yeah, and you can also send us a check too if you want to make a one-time donation. Make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. And I'll repeat that at the end of the broadcast.
That Patreon button is in the upper right corner of the website.
Of the website. It's
right next to the click to hear our live stream, which I'm sure a lot of people
which
already
we also
found.
Mean,
otherwise,
yeah.
Why are we even saying this? All right. Moving on to national and Trump administration.
Yeah, a judge in Washington state blocked the Trump administration's changes to Title 10. U.S. Judge Stanley Bastian of the Eastern District of Washington state issued a nationwide preliminary injunction against the Trump administration's rule to ban taxpayer-funded healthcare clinics from referring women to abortion providers. The new rule would have taken effect this coming Friday on May 3rd. That preliminary injunction means that that rule will not take effect temporarily while these cases against the rule are making their way through the courts. Title 10 is a law passed by Congress in 1970, almost 50 years ago, to provide funding for family planning services, particularly to help low-income women and women who live in rural areas. Federal law already prohibits the use of Title 10 money for abortions, except in the case of rape, incest, or to save the life of the woman. Instead, Title 10 money usually pays for clinics that provide contraceptive services, cancer screening for breast and ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, and for many women, just general health care treatment. Many women cite that their family planning provider is their primary healthcare provider. So funding for these clinics is really vital for many women. The new rule would have put a gag on those clinics. They could not direct a woman to an abortion provider, even if she specifically asked for a referral to one. The most that they could do would be to give her a list of primary care physicians with no information on who on that list provides abortions, if any of the primary care providers do. So they could essentially be giving her a list that had no one's name on it that could actually help her. Clinics could not refer her to any organization that's not a primary care provider, like Planned Parenthood, for example. That rule would also have required any clinic receiving Title 10 money to physically separate their abortion services from their other healthcare services, to set up a separate facility with separate equipment, separate personnel, and separate accounting. That would have been far too expensive, and many clinics would have had to close their doors. The injunction, as I said, is temporary as the cases make their way through the justice system. Now, that could be years, but because the Trump administration feels they have a conservative Supreme Court, they're definitely going to keep appealing till it ends up in the Supreme Court. I think the best hope is to hope that the cases take long enough until we get a Democratic president in 2020 who then withdraws that rule. That's the main hope here. Or to hope that we get a Congress that is willing to pass a law that invalidates that rule.
Yeah, I'd say the 2020 election is still pretty...
It's still pretty far away.
Well, and who knows who the hell's going to win it or be in the running based on our past. So,
yeah.
Well, you did bring up the election, though. So maybe we should talk about one of the people that... he's running and had some
Claire his candidacy this week.
No, not a different person.
I didn't want to talk about Joe Biden because the mainstream media is covering him to death. So let's talk instead about another candidate in that
with a little more,
in that race who had a very
progressive ideas.
Important policy issue that she talked about this week. Elizabeth Warren's proposal to forgive student debt. Critics say a lot of people immediately castigated her when she made that announcement, saying that it wouldn't help the economy. You know, it's too expensive. It rewards people who will have higher incomes when they graduate and can afford to pay off their debts, et cetera, all of which really is not true. Over the last 50 years, government has privatized the post K through 12 education financing system. Banks now make a ton of profit from students. Colleges and professors at prestigious universities are paid more than ever before. And a lot of colleges have accumulated a ton of money in their endowment programs because they've been able to jack up tuition without many limits. And of course, students are left with a huge amount of debt that it takes decades for them to pay off. Many students complain that they can't afford to buy homes, that they can't afford to have kids, they can't afford to make a move or a change from one profession to another just because they're locked into a cycle of debt at such a young age. And that has real implications for our economy. It also has implications for the growing income inequality in our society. A lot of the folks who make up the lower, 99% now are people who have graduated from college with a good degree, a degree that you would have in the past given them a decent paying job and a decent standard of living, and they're struggling to get by living paycheck to paycheck. That is primarily goes back to the way banks have been making a ton of money off of students and student debt. That's the system that has to be reversed. And that's the system that Elizabeth Warren is trying to address. This proposal to forgive student debt is to try to help students who have been locked into that system and to be a stepping stone towards something that will reverse that whole privatization of the post-secondary education financing system. It's not meant to stand alone and be the only proposal that she has, I'm sure, but it is meant to be a good first step and to help people who are struggling right now in the here and now to pay their debts and to live a decent life and to eventually save for their own kids to go to college and to save for their own retirement and to do things like buy a home, to put money in the pockets of people who can stimulate our economy. That's what she's trying to do. And that's what critics have been overlooking in order to just say, it's going to be too expensive, yada, yada. The government can't afford to do that. Well, the government used to do that. It's not like the government has never done it. It used to do that. We need to go back to those days when the government exerted some control over tuition costs and allowed students to get things like Pell Grants and to afford their own education and not have it be such a huge debt burden when they graduate.
All right. Moving on. Did you want to talk more about Trump next or
No, let's
Boeing?
Talk for a bit about Boeing's problems with their quality control. I mentioned this a little bit earlier today. On Monday, the New York Times ran an article entitled Claims of Shoddy Production Draw Scrutiny to a Second Boeing Jet. It focuses on problems at the North Charleston plant in South Carolina. Boeing originally opened that plant to take advantage of lower labor costs and a non-union work environment in South Carolina. In fact, Boeing told its managers at that time not to let any trained personnel from Washington State travel to Charleston to communicate with workers in the new plant because they could infect the North Charleston workers with a desire to unionize their workplace. But this has, of course, ultimately backfired, keeping trained personnel away from the new underskilled workers in North Charleston means that Boeing jets are now rolling off the line there that could have major defects in them. In addition, the lack of a union means that North Charleston workers have no means to fight against management-driven, profit-driven speed-ups that are affecting airplane quality. At least a dozen workers have blown the whistle and reported manufacturing problems at the North Charleston plant to the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA has found multiple instances of safety and quality control violations at the North Charleston plant. Boeing says it's working to fix them, but thousands of planes have already come off the line there and been sold to airlines, and those airplanes may contain faulty parts or debris left in the engines or other critical parts of the jets. According to the article, at least one Boeing customer, Qatar Airways, has refused to accept any new planes made at the North Charleston plant. Instead, their contract with Boeing specifies that they will only take union-built planes from the Everett, Washington plant. That should tell you something. Now, these are the same issues that Boeing workers and the unions brought up when Boeing opened the North Charleston plant back in 2011. And they're the same issues that Boeing workers have protested about and talked about when the company outsourced the production of parts to China and to other countries, that the use of lower-skilled, lower-paid workers in foreign countries and in other parts of the United States where there's not where the company does not allow union organizing is currently affecting the quality of Boeing's products, and it's now affecting their business bottom line. And we will see if it leads to any changes in the North Charleston plant or in changes in the way Boeing does business. My guess is it won't until the FAA gets a whole lot tougher about the quality of Boeing's products.
Well, and returns to doing inspections itself as opposed
instead
to offloading
of allowing the company to hire a person to do the inspections for the FAA.
Yeah,
yes.
And then putting time constraints on how, you know, a limited amount of time you have to like do this full inspection.
Mm-hmm.
We need it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
They also had this just today, I believe, CNN posted an article about there's been four shortly after the most recent crash of the 737 MAX that four whistleblowers from Boeing had contacted them with concerns about problems with the wiring on that particular line and foreign objects found inside the plane.
Yes, that's one of the main issues, and it's talked about extensively in the New York Times article too. That when you speed up the production line, people don't have time to clean up after themselves. And so you end up with foreign debris and sometimes around wires. When you're up in the air, thousands of feet in the air, and you have debris around wiring, that can cause a short.
Especially if you're bouncing around.
You're bouncing around,
turbulence.
Yeah. You have debris in an aircraft engine. That can cause an engine to fail during a flight.
And
you have debris in the tail section, which can cause the rudder to go out. Those are serious problems. You know, you're talking about all those people in that airplane dying in that kind of a situation.
Meanwhile, this week, apparently after their, I guess a lot of major corporations did their quarterly reports this week and had phone teleconferencing and
mm-hmm.
The day after that, Boeing basically announced that they're looking at hoping to have the and the FAA mainly announcing that they'll remove the they'll put the 737s back in the sky. They're hoping to start the process the end of May or June.
Mm-hmm.
Boeing has had 134 test flights with the new software, and they're very confident that they've got it figured out.
As if the software is the only problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's not obviously the only problem. Now, one of the issues too brought up by the New York Times article is that managers had pushed their own engineers and inspectors to use faulty parts, to not throw away faulty parts. To actually take them back out of the barrel and put them in a plane. Now that is criminal in my opinion, and not having FAA inspectors there to hear those complaints, to take seriously these Boeing whistleblowers saying that they've seen that, and to hear them hear people who work on these airplanes say that they are not willing to get on and fly on a Boeing jet because they know what could be in one of those airplanes and that they don't feel that they're safe enough to get into the air. That's something the FAA needs to take seriously. And they need to penalize Boeing for this. They need to make sure that jets that roll off the line in the future don't come off the line with faulty parts in them and debris in critical parts of the plane. They also need to make sure that Boeing goes back to the airlines that they've sold these jets to and does real meaningful inspections and make sure that there aren't faulty parts and there isn't debris in those jets, because clearly there's a safety issue here, because we've seen two jets crash already and it isn't completely just the software that is at issue. There have been jets that have been grounded because of fires and because of other things, jets that are brand new. And clearly there was some issue with the manufacturer of those planes.
And is regardless of what the decision is and when they decide to start letting these planes go back into the air, as Ralph Nader pointed out previously on his show multiple times, it airs just before mm-hmm. we go on here, as passengers, you are, it's easy enough to contact the airline prior
and
to your flight
out
and find out which
what kind of plane you're
going
to be getting
on.
On
and, mm-hmm. you know.
A lot of
changes.
Yeah, a lot of airlines will list that on their websites. They'll tell you what kind of a plane. Are you flying on an Airbus? Are you flying on a Boeing? You know, it'll show you what kind of plane and what model number and everything. And it is possible as a consumer, as a person flying, to make the decision that you're going to boycott Boeing until they get their act together.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay, let's bounce back to Donald Trump and digging those heels in.
Oh, yeah. He's now trying to claim executive privilege after waiving his executive privilege and surrendering documents to the Mueller investigation. He wants to keep Democrats in Congress from getting hold of any of the supporting documents for the Mueller report. But the fact that Attorney General William Barr released the Mueller report to Congress and the public with Trump's agreement may mean that Donald Trump doesn't really have a legal leg to stand on now that he's trying to exert his executive privilege to hold back the supporting documents. But he's digging in his heels anyway this week. Trump announced that he's going to fight every and all subpoena. He and his businesses filed suit against Representative Elijah Cummings, the chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, in an effort to block his subpoena for Trump's financial records. Trump's lawyers also sought to block a subpoena for records from an accounting company, Mazars USA, which has done work for Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. The Oversight Committee issued that subpoena after Michael Cohen, who used to be Trump's personal attorney, testified before the committee that Trump often exaggerated or misrepresented his finances in order to suit his needs, which means that he may have committed bank fraud. Mazars USA has assisted Donald Trump and the Trump Organization in preparing financial statements, which they then submitted to banks for loan applications. Now, if you submit false information for a loan from a bank, you're committing bank fraud. Another thing that the House Oversight and Reform Committee is looking into is Michael Cohen's testimony that Donald Trump sometimes understated his assets. That could mean that he may have committed tax fraud, which is why getting a hold of his tax returns is very, very important. Three other House committees are investigating Donald Trump. The House Ways and Means Committee demanded 6 years of Trump's tax returns to see if he has potentially committed tax fraud. And the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, this week has refused to turn those over, saying he needs more time, he needs more time. Clearly, he's stalling here in an effort to keep from releasing something that could be not just a potential embarrassment for Donald Trump, but could expose criminal activity. And both the House Intelligence Committee and the Financial Services Committee have subpoenaed several banks for their records related to Donald Trump's loans. That includes Deutsche Bank, which is his biggest lender. In addition, Trump's legal team is advising witnesses now not to testify before Congress or speak to any legislators on Capitol Hill. That includes Donald McGahn, who was Trump's former White House counsel, and Carl Klein, who is the former head of personnel security at the White House. Klein was asked to speak to the House Oversight and Reform Committee to answer questions about security clearances that he granted to Trump personnel who didn't pass their security screenings. That would include Trump's own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, whose security screening raised red flags about his foreign contacts and conflicts of interest, particularly business dealings that he'd done abroad. An example would be business dealings that he'd done with Saudi Arabian millionaires to fund the loans and the sale of properties for his own family business. Now, the House can vote to hold witnesses in contempt if they don't appear in response to a subpoena. The House can also request that a judge order a witness to appear before Congress or else face legal sanctions. Those legal sanctions might include arrest or fines. So Trump may be able to delay the investigations, but I don't think that he can ultimately stop them. And I think at this point, there are enough Democrats in the House pushing for more of that information, even the House leadership, although they have said they do not want to impeach Trump, they have been firm in saying that they want more investigations and they want more material from Donald Trump and his businesses. So there is a big effort right now to push to get that information. I don't think Democrats are going to hold back on that just because Donald Trump is now digging in his heels.
Let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope.
A little bit of transparency would be good at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Settling even for a little bit.
Settling for a little bit. I would like a lot of transparency.
I would prefer that. I'm just, but, you know, my expectation levels.
Given that other presidents in the recent past have released their tax returns, I think it's high time Donald Trump does the same.
Even Bernie Sanders on April 15th released his.
Oh yeah, instead of continuing to claim year after year after year that he's being audited, really raises the question of, okay, what is it in your tax return that is causing the IRS to continue to audit you? Or if it's not the IRS, if it's a public accounting firm that you've paid to audit you, so what? Release your tax returns. You know, we don't care that you're paying a public accounting firm to audit your financial statements. We want to see what you have.
All right. We have a lot of events, but before we get to that, let's talk about Extinction Rebellion.
A little bit about Extinction Rebellion. Yeah, they wrapped up two full weeks of protests in London this week with Greta Thunberg speaking to the UK Parliament about how the UK government needs to do more to address global warming and to speed up the timeline for cutting their greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, here in the US, our own government needs to do something, because we are not doing anything. I find this to be one of the two things that is very interesting about the Extinction Rebellion protests, is that the UK government is already doing something about climate change and their greenhouse gas emissions. While here in the United States, our federal government is going backwards, not only doing nothing, but denying the existence of climate change and saying that it's all just a conspiracy to help China or whatever hallucination Donald Trump is having that week. But here in the United States, we need a movement on the order of Extinction Rebellion sevenfold, I think, because the United States, we need to get rid of this idiot idea that nothing is happening to the climate and that it's not related to human activity. We need to get rid of that, and we need to urge the government to begin to do something, not just more, but something. And the other thing that strikes me about the Extinction Rebellion protests is the absolute creativity and the joy with which these activists took to the streets and did their protests. A lot of times, I think on the left, we think we have to talk seriously and we have to be dour and we have to guilt trip people. I think the great thing about the protests, as I read about them and watched some of the video of them, is how creative the protesters were and how it looked like a good time. It looked like a party to benefit the planet. And while that can bring up criticisms from people saying, why are you laughing? Why are you partying in the streets? You know, you got to make it fun or people don't show up. Okay. And it's an urgent issue. And people need hope in times when the issues are urgent and in times when you're talking about something that could affect the survival of the human race. You got to give people hope. In that respect, it really, to me, looked a lot like the WTO protests here in Seattle in the late 90s and a lot of the protests worldwide to deal with the WTO and with setting up this global forum that would allow corporations to determine what laws federal and local governments could pass to regulate businesses in their jurisdictions. It's time to do something on that order and with that spirit to address global warming and to address climate change and to get the U.S. federal government to do something.
And there is a chapter, a local chapter.
There is.
Extinction Rebellion Seattle, which they have a presence on Facebook. You can look them up there.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're...
And if you have a good creative idea for a protest, take it to them.
Yeah. Or you can start one yourself. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll look up their web address
while I'm talking about events.
Talking about events.
Yeah. This weekend is the Langston Hughes African American Film Festival through Sunday evening. That's at 104 17th Avenue South. To find out more about what they're showing, you can go to their website at www.langstonseattle.org. On Monday, the 29th, there's a panel on racism and white supremacy in algorithms, exploring how information technology can replicate racial bias. Panel members include Nikita Oliver, Shankar Narayan of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project, Halima Barucha of the Greenlining Institute, and others. That's at Kane Hall, room 210, from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday. On Tuesday, the 30th, at 1 p.m., is the ICE deportation hearing for immigration activist Meru Mora Villapando. There will be a rally afterwards. Come early and bring signs and show moral support for her. That's at the Federal Building at 2nd and Marion downtown on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Wednesday is May Day, and it's the 20th anniversary march for immigrant and workers' rights. The rally will start at noon, and the march begins at 1 p.m. That's at 20th Place South and South Dearborn Street in Judkins Park. There will also be a contingent of women and families who will be marching at a more accommodating pace. That group will assemble at 20th and Weller at 2:30 p.m. Saturday, on May 4th, Red May and Elliott Bay Book Company are hosting Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. It's a talk by the authors of a new anti-capitalist feminist manifesto. That's from 7 to 9 p.m. at Elliott Bay Book Company at 1521 10th Avenue on Capitol Hill. If you can't catch those folks on Saturday night, you can hear them speak again on Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Northwest Film Forum at 1515 12th Avenue on Capitol Hill. Saturday, May 5th, also at 8 p.m., is the White Privilege...
May 4th.
May 4th, yeah, is the White Privilege Symposium Northwest to examine white privilege and work towards a more equitable, inclusive society. Keynote speakers are Yusuf Salam of the Central Park Five, Robin D'Angelo, and Gyasi Ross. That's at Highline College, 2400 South 240th Street in Des Moines. Next weekend is also the edible plant sale at Tilth. Tilth supports sustainable in-city agriculture. This is their big May fundraiser. So come and stock up on plant starts for your garden from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on both Saturday and Sunday at 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North.
And isn't today Independent Bookstore
and
Day?
Today is Independent Bookstore Day. So
you
visit your local Independent Bookstore.
Go out to an Independent Bookstore.
Elliott Bay University Bookstore, Third Place Books, Queen Anne Books, Magnolia Books. They're all over the city still. Go and show them some love and buy some really good reading material.
And the web address for Extinction Rebellion Seattle is seattlerebellion.earth. .earth.
E-A-R-T-H.
Yes, for those that can't spell. All right. And I want to remind you that we are completely... Independent. We are also independent here at KODX.
All volunteer supported.
And can use your support.
And all listener supported.
That's right. No underwriters of yet. So you that are listening,
we're underwritten by our listeners.
That's right. That's right.
And to be part of that group, you can go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon button at the top right. Also, if you want to make a one-time donation, we will certainly accept your check. Mm-hmm. You can make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media, which is the name of our foundation. And you can mail it to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.